It's the takeaway for July 24th.
It is unusual for a prosecutor to testify about a criminal investigation.
Former special counsel Robert Mueller in front of the House. We break down the highly anticipated back and forth. Also on the show, a new federal audit found that some hospitals put Native American communities at risk for opioid misuse.
That report looked at whether the hospitals were following their own policies and found that many times they weren't, and as a result, were putting people at higher risk for opioid abuse or overdoses.
And the USDA is halting data collection for its annual report on honeybees.
Bees?
Bees.
There is no one stressor that is impacting bees. We think there are multiple factors that are responsible for the bee declines that we have seen over the past decade.
That much and more today, but let's get started with Mueller time.
Our report contains our findings and analysis and the reasons for the decisions we made. We conducted an extensive investigation over 2 years. In writing the report, we stated the results of our investigation with precision. We scrutinized every word. We do not intend to summarize or describe the results of our work in a different way in the course of my testimony today.
Today, former special counsel Robert Mueller testified before the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees to address his investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 election and whether President Trump or his associates attempted to conspire with the Russian government. But before today's hearings, Mueller has said the report itself was his testimony, a line he continued to stick with today.
Well, I would have to refer you to the report on that.
I rely on the report.
I'll leave it with the report.
I refer to the report on that,
and I send you back to the report.
But lawmakers on both sides of the aisle still tried to get more revealing information.
And what about total exoneration? Did you actually totally exonerate the president?
No.
Now, in fact, your report expressly states that it does not exonerate the president.
It does.
When the special counsel's office interviewed Mifsud, did he lie to you guys, too?
Can't get into that.
A lot of things you can't get into.
Why did the president of the United States want you fired?
I can't answer that question.
Was anything in Attorney General Barr's letter referred to as the principal conclusions letter dated March 24th inaccurate?
Well, I am not going to get into that.
You made a political case instead. You put it in a paper sack, lit it on fire, dropped it on our porch, rang the doorbell, and ran.
And when Donald Trump called your investigation a witch hunt, that was also false, was it not?
I'd like to think so, yes.
Well, your investigation is not a witch hunt, is it?
It is not a witch hunt. Let me say one more thing. Over the course of my career, I have seen a number of challenges to our democracy. The Russian government's effort to interfere in our election is among the most serious. As I said on May 29th, this deserves the attention of every American.
We're going to try to answer some of those lingering questions. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. But I have someone with us who is not just going to refer back to the report, and that's Max Kuttner, who's been with us a number of times over the past few months on this story. He's a journalist covering the FBI, the Justice Department, and the Russia probes. Matt, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So, Max, the big news of the day came from Judiciary Chair Jerry Nadler's line of questioning, where he explicitly asked Robert Mueller if the report exonerated the president, and Mueller answered no. Is that the headline?
That is one of the big sound bites today. It does seem that this Democrat strategy to ask true or false and yes or no answers is getting those headlines, getting those sound bites that they want. That said, a lot of what is seeming like big news today, it's all in the report. It might have been muddled by commentators, might have been muddled by previous statements by Justice Department leaders. So this is exactly what the Democrats wanted to do, bring this report to life and bring out those key details.
When we turn now to the Intelligence Committee testimony, and that's focusing much more on Russian interference, something that Mueller has repeatedly said is the most important thing to come out of the report. I want to take a listen now to Intelligence Chair Adam Schiff's questioning of Mueller.
When the president said the Russian interference was a hoax, that was false, wasn't it?
True.
In short, your investigation found evidence that Russia wanted to help Trump win the election, right?
I think generally that would be accurate.
Russia committed federal crimes in order to help Donald Trump?
When you're talking about the computer crimes in the charge in our case, absolutely.
The Trump campaign officials built their strategy, their messaging strategy around those stolen documents?
Generally, that's true.
And then they lied to cover it up?
Generally, that's true.
So, Max, again, we're seeing that pattern of Democrats starting off the testimony, the hearings here with yes or no questions. This, to me, felt pretty substantial. What were your thoughts on that exchange?
Right. And this is from volume one of the report. That's what this whole Intelligence Committee hearing is about, which was all about the Russian interference. Again, I think this was a really effective strategy. We're seeing it play out. Now, this is something, the Russian interference to help Trump and denigrate Hillary Clinton. This is something we have been hearing about for years. The U.S. intelligence community came together, published this report in January 2017, weeks before the inauguration of Trump. And so it's not new. We keep hearing it. But now this is yet another authority telling us what happened, and the leaders of national security agencies, intel agencies, are saying we need to start taking this seriously. And I wonder how many more of these reports and probes it's going to take for people to take it seriously, especially as 2020 election comes up.
Mueller has made this such a repeated, of the few things that he does say, this is the thing that he's telling people to pay attention to. Why hasn't this been the main focus of a lot of the coverage that we're seeing out there on this?
I think because it's not so new. Even though it isn't catching on, we have been hearing about it for so long. The U.S. federal government first acknowledged it under the Obama administration in October 2016, weeks before the election. There's some debate about whether even that was too late and things should have come out earlier. My reporting has showed that James Comey at the time had wanted to reveal this in an op-ed. He was going to write it for the New York Times or another newspaper at the time, and he was stopped from doing so. But so we know this already. Now that it is the subject of this hours-long hearing, I think it will get more attention. I think this was a really effective job of separating the hearings between the obstruction issue this morning and now the Russia issue.
One of the things, Max, that stood out to me, and again, in this in the Schiff yes-no question back and forth, was when he asked Mueller whether this was a witch hunt. And Mueller responded, "It's not a witch hunt." Were you as stunned by that as I was?
I was. That moment did stand out because he could have just said a yes or no or a true or false as he had previously been doing, but he took the time to answer that question.
And is that also in line with Mueller's wanting to almost defend the work as it was done and the people that did that work?
Absolutely. It seems the moments when he's actually taking time to push back, to answer these questions, even raise his voice even a tiny bit, is when the integrity of his team and his work is questioned.
On the whole, as we mentioned at the top, Mueller has kept his answers very short. Often the questions are yes or no questions. And many times he's referred to some variation of saying, "I refer to the report," or "that's not within the purview," or "his purview," without elaborating what's in the report. Is there a strategy behind his doing that? Or is he pretty much sticking to what he said from the beginning, which is, "I'm not going to speak outside of these parameters"?
He's sticking to that, Tanzina. And this is just typical Mueller. This is how he was as FBI director. I've heard it from so many different sources. He is the anti-Comey. That's not to say he doesn't like Comey. That's to say he was just so different from him. Whereas we heard James Comey in one of these hearings say that he felt nauseous to hear that he might have impacted the election. We're not getting any of that from Mueller. In fact, even asked why he accepted the job of special counsel, he could have said something like, "It's his duty to serve the country." Instead, he said, quote, "I'm not going to go into that."
What else are your sources telling you about the hearings? I mean, you've talked to people who know Mueller quite well.
Yeah, I spoke with one of his longtime friends today who was watching, and he told me, quote, "He clearly does not want to be there and is not comfortable, and this is the wrong format to get anything good out of him." I also spoke with a former senior official at the FBI who worked under Mueller. He said, "I know Mueller hates having to testify. He seems disoriented." So they both feel that this just isn't comfortable for him. This isn't the setting he likes to be in. We know from reporting on the Russia investigation that he would sit in the back of the room during these witness interviews. So I think he likes being in the back of the room, hearing others give information and not being up front answering these questions.
In terms of the Republican strategy, we saw several Republicans in the initial hearings this morning who questioned Mueller and sought to sort of undermine the work of his team by essentially calling his hires biased against Donald Trump and against the Republican Party. I want to play an exchange here between North Dakota Republican Kelly Armstrong and Robert Mueller.
We strove to hire those individuals that could do the job. I've been in this business for almost 25 years. And in those 25 years, I have not had occasion once to ask somebody about their political affiliation. It is not done. What I care about is the capability of the individual to do the job and do the job quickly and seriously and with integrity.
Again, Mueller there, uncharacteristically, I wouldn't say emotional, but definitely more verbal there than he has been so far. Is there any evidence, Max, about that political bias did play into any of Mueller's hires and whether or not the Russia investigation and how it played out?
Well, the Republicans certainly think so. And some of the Republicans today, or at least one of them, did enumerate what they feel are these examples of it. And you can see it's public information, donations to the Hillary Clinton campaign. Aaron Zebley, who is sitting beside Mueller today and is now technically a sworn-in witness this afternoon, he represented a Hillary Clinton aide. So there are these cases, but as Mueller said, he does not ask political affiliation. This does not mean bias just because you represent someone or just because you make these donations. We talked about, Tanzina, what he is not saying. So I think it's so important to look at what he is saying, which is the clip you just played. He seems to be speaking up and pushing back only in these instances when his team or his work is under scrutiny.
Max, we're pretty much at the end of Mueller's public testimony. I mean, this is probably the last time we'll see Robert Mueller in this life. I mean, I think he goes into private life back again, probably forever after this. But what happens from here? I mean, what do we take away from this other than a political and media spectacle?
Well, Congress is hoping, or at least the Democrats are hoping, to take information from these hearings and now perhaps explore impeachment. And we heard that from one of the last members of Congress to speak this morning at the House Judiciary Committee hearing. Might have been the closing note of that hearing when she said it is now our turn to take it and move forward. So that's what we'll have to be following now. We'll see what happens with Mueller, whether he'll return to his law firm WilmerHale, whether more committees will bring him out, such as the Senate Judiciary Committee, perhaps. So that we'll see what happens with that.
Max Kuttner is a journalist covering the FBI, the Justice Department, and the Russia probes. As always, thank you, Max.
Thank you.
And the White House released a statement between the two hearings today saying, quote, the last 3 hours have been an epic embarrassment for the Democrats.
I rely on the report. I refer you to the report. Again, I refer you to the report. That's what it says in the report. Yes, and I stand behind the report. I refer to the report on that. I refer to the write-up of this in the report. Well, I would have to refer you to the report on that. I refer you to the write-up of it in the report. I refer you to the report. I direct you to the report for how that is characterized. I rely on the language of the report. I'm just going to leave it in, as it appears in the report. Well, I would, again, refer you to the report and the way it is characterized in the report. I again refer you to the discussion that's found on page 115. I'm going to ask you to rely on what we wrote about those, and I would send you back to the report. And I leave it with the report.
The Trump administration and congressional leaders are trying to whip up support for a new $1.37 trillion budget deal. With just a few days left before legislators ditch Washington for August, there's little time to pass the budget and prevent the U.S. from defaulting on its debts in September. The deal would raise the debt ceiling, something Republicans rail against when a Democrat is in office, but are more likely to support under a GOP president. Eric Wasson is a congressional reporter for Bloomberg News.
In 2011, there was a debt ceiling crisis, and at that time, Republicans forced President Obama to agree to 10 years of budget caps, essentially lowering the discretionary part of the budget by hundreds of billions of dollars over the decade. And this would turn those cuts off for the next 2 years. And in fact, it doesn't even extend the budget caps beyond that. This is a big victory for Nancy Pelosi. Defense hawks in the Republican Party are pretty happy with it. It would increase defense spending. And that's the way that President Trump and other Republican leaders are selling it to their members. And Nancy Pelosi, you know, only controlling the House and facing Republican Senate and Republican White House, was able to increase domestic spending on domestic programs. So this is a big victory for her. You know, she said she would never take the debt ceiling hostage, so she kind of played it very light. But she did insist that the debt ceiling be attached to this type of budget deal. And then the last hangup in the deal was finding some way to pay for it. The White House, led by Mick Mulvaney, who made his reputation as a fiscal hawk, tried to attach about $1 trillion in spending cuts and reforms to the deal. Pelosi balked at that and ended up agreeing only to $77 billion. And this is causing a real split in the Republican Party. There are fiscal hawks who will vote against this. In fact, there are some moderate Democrats who may vote against it because of the price tag.
Let's drill down on that a little bit, because we mentioned Pelosi's happy. This is a good look for her. But who's unhappy? And let's talk about the split in the Republican Party a little bit more.
I think we're really seeing unhappiness on the wings of both parties. You know, on the right wing, we have Ted Cruz. You know, Senator John Kennedy from Louisiana came out and said a quote that I thought was pretty great, which he said, you know, cutting spending around here is a lot like going to heaven. Everyone wants to go, but no one wants to take the trip. People talk about cutting spending or you know, reducing government expenditures, but when it comes to actually figuring out what to cut, they won't do it. You know, the big drivers of the debt are Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, but these programs are very, very popular. Mitch McConnell, when he was pressed on why he's supporting this deal, talked about raising the retirement age, but there's really no prospect of doing that. It's deeply unpopular. So I think on the Republican side, you have people who are worried about the deficit, but when it came to the tax cut, which did add $2 trillion to the deficit, they voted for it. On the Democratic side, there is some consternation about the debt ceiling being raised only to July 31st, 2021. This would be in the first 6 months of the next president's term. And let's say it is a progressive Democrat who's in office. Most likely, they'll be facing Mitch McConnell across the table in a Republican Senate. And he could try to use the debt ceiling to sort of put a crimp on their policy proposals. So there are some liberals who will probably vote against it over this issue.
Speaking with Bloomberg News reporter Eric Wasson, and we're talking about the federal budget deal announced earlier this week. Eric, there's a word that sort of we've almost forgotten about here. A lot has been made about how this deal eliminates something, automatic budget cuts, and that word is the sequester. We remember that back from budget negotiations back in 2014. How big of a part of the deal is that elimination of the sequester, if you will?
Well, there were going to be $126 billion in cuts. They would have taken effect 15 days after Congress adjourned. So we were looking at late December or early January. And this was really sort of a cliff. Now, you know, in a huge economy like we have, it would be a small crimp on spending, but still, nonetheless, it could prevent a fiscal challenge. You know, for President Trump, a key part of this deal and his biggest asset going into this reelection campaign is the roaring economy. So he's removed the threat of spending cuts. He's also removed the threat of a debt ceiling crisis. You know, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin came out with a new estimate that the debt ceiling could have been impacted in early September. That would have caused a payments default. That's different than a government shutdown, which actually does still loom in October because they have to pass spending bills in order to accord with this budget outline. But, you know, he forecasted in early September we would have a potential payment default. Now, that caused a lot of nervousness in the Treasury market. It also causes nervousness in the stock market. So President Trump has really locked down, if this deal does go through, you know, something that would sort of preserve his greatest asset, which is a roaring economy.
Since 2016, President Trump has been talking a lot about paying down the federal debt, and that debt has hit about $22 trillion since he came into office. If this budget is passed, while it will keep the lights on for the federal government, the deficit would now be on pace to be over $1 trillion a year. How does the White House square these two things?
You know, it's very interesting. Even before this deal, it was already on pace to be about $900 billion next year. This will probably take it up above the $1 trillion mark. And that compares to about half that amount in the last year of the Obama administration. You know, President Trump, you know, he has promoted these tax cuts. He's signed on to bipartisan spending deals. And this has all made him a real deficit spender. And this is not core to his message. It's to distribute benefits to get the economy going. That's what they want to focus on. They're also focusing on the military. They say that that sequester, that automatic set of budget cuts, was a real threat to the military. And they point to military and national security threats coming out of the Middle East or Asia, and say that we need to have a bigger defense. Questionable. I mean, there are certainly some people who argue that you don't need to have $750 billion, which this deal would approach per year for the Pentagon.
Now, what about Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin? What's he doing in order to get support for this budget?
He's actually a very interesting. He's the protagonist of all this. Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, and Treasury Secretary Mnuchin are the ones who negotiated this. Over several weeks, they were in constant contact. A key part of these deals is finding people who can talk to each other. No one on Capitol Hill, either on the Republican or Democratic side, really had a good relationship with Mick Mulvaney, who's the chief of staff. He was in Congress as a Tea Party congressman from South Carolina. He burned a lot of bridges at that time. He also was someone who had tried to use the debt ceiling to get his way in 2011. So they had to find someone that Pelosi could talk to, and it turned out to be Mnuchin. Now he's got to sell it. He was up in the Senate Republican lunch on Tuesday trying to sell it to skeptical Republicans, and arguing that, in a divided government where you have an election that produces a Democratic House, Republican Senate, Republican White House, this is the best that he could do.
Eric, how likely is it that this is going to pass? And if it doesn't, what next?
Well, it's looking like it's on track. There'll be a big meetings in the middle of the week to try to figure out, where the vote count lies exactly. But Republican and Democratic leaders are expressing confidence. Steve Scalise, the Republican whip, told me that it would pass. Nancy Pelosi also told me that it would pass. So I think that they usually project confidence, but I did sense that it was actually authentic. If it doesn't pass, there was talk of doing a short-term debt ceiling extension. This is something Treasury bill investors do not like, that markets do not like, into October. That would leave a lot of uncertainty hanging over everyone. Essentially, the House is slated to go on a six-week recess on Friday, and that would mean that they need to do a short-term debt ceiling increase because of the forecast that it could see a default in early September before they got back.
Eric Wasson is a congressional reporter for Bloomberg News. Eric, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks so much.
A database tracking the path of every pain pill sold to pharmacies in the United States was recently made public by the Drug Enforcement Administration. The Washington Post sifted through the data to find that drug companies distributed over 76 billion oxycodone and hydrocodone pills over the course of 7 years, reshaping the public's understanding of the role that drug companies, distributors, and pharmacies have played in this crisis. In October, we'll see the first case of consolidated lawsuits by some 2,000 plaintiffs against drug companies go to trial in Ohio. My next guest says that that's the largest civil trial in U.S. history, and it's set to be a major legal test of how much responsibility can be laid at the feet of drug companies for the opioid crisis. Lenny Bernstein is health and medicine reporter for The Washington Post. Lenny, great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with this huge database. What did the data tell us about the opioid crisis, especially in its early days?
Well, we knew that there were a lot of opioids being shipped around this country. What we didn't know is that there were 76 billion, with a B, shipped between 2006 and 2012. That is a number that I, even covering this for the past several years, had no idea about. I had no idea it was going to be that large. We don't know how many of those were diverted to illicit use in the on the street, but let's say it's 1%. That's 760 million pills. That's just an incredible amount.
Now, how and who was responsible for distributing these pills? Was it the drug companies, the pharmacies, the doctors? Like who and how did these pills make it to the market and to ultimately to Americans?
All of the above. The manufacturers produce them. There are distribution companies. That group is dominated by three major companies, McKesson, Cardinal Health, and AmerisourceBergen. They go to the drugstores, Of course, we all know the big chains among the drugstores, but also to mom and pops and small individual private drugstores. And then, of course, if the system is working correctly, you can't walk into one of those drugstores and buy an opioid without a prescription from your doctor. So there are four parts to the chain, basically, and that's how opioids are supposed to get to legitimate users.
Now, do we know, were there any specific geographic or demographic trends that stood out to you when you looked at the data? Were there certain communities that saw higher levels of the distribution of hydrocodone and oxycodone pills, for example?
It's roughly the way we have come to understand it over the years. Appalachia, West Virginia, New England, some of the northern Midwestern states have been hit very hard. But of course, we knew that anecdotally. We could go to those places and see the number of overdose deaths and the level of addiction in those places. We also saw little pockets. There's a pocket in Nevada or a county here or there in another state that maybe didn't come to our attention. And then, of course, we've had CDC data now for years that's shown the escalating use of these prescription opioids as well as heroin and fentanyl in the second and third waves of the epidemic.
Why are we only getting access to this data now?
The DEA has been keeping it for many, many years, but it's been under wraps. It's been kept private. Their argument was that this was not public data. The drug companies were very, very zealous in trying to keep this information under wraps. Their argument was that if it got out, then it could give their competitors an advantage. So all the drug companies were claiming that this was proprietary. The Washington Post and the Charleston Gazette Mail sued back in 2016 when these legal cases started moving forward. And we said, this is information that the public has a right to have. We lost at the federal level, but we won at the appellate court. The appellate court judge told Judge Polster, who was overseeing that giant federal case that you referred to make this information available, and also some of the filings that have been put in that court case.
Some of the posts, the Washington Post reporting talks about internal drug company emails, which are showing, I guess you could say, indifference by top executives to opioid addiction and deaths. Can you give us some more on that? Why did the companies, was this really about profit over people?
It appears that way to some people. We have the example of the executive at Mallinckrodt, the largest manufacturer of opioids, telling someone, just like Doritos, you know, keep eating, we'll keep making them. We had several examples in our reporting over the past 10 days in which people at various points in the chain, the compliance chain at these various companies would say, gosh, that is an awful lot of opioids. Can that possibly be legit? And then generally they would be told, don't worry about it. We're shipping. That needs to go out. They need those drugs. Now, sure, plenty of legit users out there, people in very serious pain from cancer, end-of-life care, the things that opioids are intended for. But when you are a company and you can see that you are shipping millions of pills to one pharmacy in a town of 400 people, you're supposed to stop that and warn the DEA. And that didn't happen. And that didn't happen over and over and over again.
Lenny, have the drug companies responded to this report so far?
So far, they have issued a variety of responses. Their main one is that the doctors are mostly responsible because doctors write prescriptions. Opioids can't be issued without a prescription. That is true. A rogue doctor who is willing to sell his prescription pad can do an awful lot of damage, but he doesn't have the view from 30,000 feet that the companies had.
Sounds like a little bit of passing of the buck.
There's culpability all along the supply chain, but the law makes the distributors responsible for flagging the suspicious orders and telling the DEA.
Lenny Bernstein covers health and medicine for The Washington Post. Lenny, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Last week, the Department of Health and Human Services Office of the Inspector General released a scathing report on the Indian Health Service and its role in the opioid epidemic. The Indian Health Service, also known as IHS, is the federal agency responsible for providing health care to indigenous communities throughout the U.S., with 24 hospitals serving more than 2.6 million people. According to the Inspector General's report, five different IHS hospitals they reviewed were prescribing opioids in high amounts exceeding federal regulations and placing patients at risk of dependency and overdose. The Inspector General also found that hospitals did not always screen patients before prescribing opioids or use prescription monitoring programs that can deter abuse and addiction. Many IHS hospitals are located in remote areas throughout the country, and the agency has been historically underfunded, making treatment difficult to access. This is especially troubling for a population with limited resources and one that has some of the highest rates of opioid addiction in the country. Joining us to discuss all this is Felicia Fonseca, Northern Arizona reporter for the Associated Press. She focuses on Native Americans for the AP's race and ethnicity team. Felicia, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So tell us about the initial findings or the top line findings of the report that really looks at five Indian Health Service hospitals.
Sure. The Office of Inspector General for the Health and Human Services Department released an audit on Monday that looks at five of the roughly two dozen hospitals that are run by the Federal Indian Health Service across tribal lands. And that report looked at whether the hospitals were following their own policies in describing and dispensing opioids and found that many times they weren't, and as a result, were putting people at higher risk for opioid abuse or overdoses.
Now, was there anything about the hospitals, like in terms of where they were located or why they were audited?
You know, the Inspector General's office said it looked at a few things when deciding which hospitals it was going to review, looking at the rate at which they prescribed opioids, looking at data over a certain number of years, and they were really trying to represent some geographic diversity. So we've got one hospital in Minnesota, North Dakota, Oklahoma, New Mexico, and Arizona represented in that. Each of them is in a different agency, as the IHS calls it, so overseen by different regional leadership.
We've done a lot of reporting here on The Takeaway about how the opioid crisis has affected Americans across the country, but we often don't hear as much about it in indigenous communities. How bad or how broad, should we say, is the opioid crisis in among indigenous populations?
The OIG's report makes some notes about the rates at which American Indians and Alaska Native communities are experiencing, you know, problems from overdoses. In 2017, they said Native Americans had the second highest rate of opioid overdose out of all U.S. racial and ethnic groups, but it's been worse before. So the CDC looked at rates, you know, from 1999 to 2015 and found then that the same population had the highest rate among all groups in the U.S.
Who is responsible for dispensing these opioids? Was it the hospital staff or the Indian Health Service, or is it still hard to tell?
Well, the Indian Health Service runs the hospitals, and so people who work for the Indian Health Service would be responsible for dispensing those. Each of the hospitals has a pharmacy, so if we go, you know, anywhere in the U.S. and pick up our medication at a pharmacy, that would be the same as it is at IHS.
Felicia, what are some of the challenges for accessing opioid addiction treatment in indigenous communities? I mean, do these communities have access to adequate programs to treat addiction?
You know, a lot of tribal communities, because in rural areas, struggle to have the, you know, substance abuse services for people. But that's been a push through multiple congressional hearings that had focused on, you know, IHS policies. IHS has also said that it's taken some efforts to, you know, create a website and make sure that people are aware of the prescribing rates and the dispensing rates among its own facilities. They have trained their providers in giving out Narcan that will reverse the effects of opioid use.
Considering this audit, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little more about the state of the Indian Health Service in general and the hospitals that are part of that network. Are they being funded adequately?
No, the IHS is chronically underfunded, and that's been subject of multiple congressional hearings over the years and efforts to increase the budget of IHS. IHS is a primary health care administered to all Native Americans, so about 2.2 million people in the U.S. There were also a lot of problems with trying to attract and retain people to Indian Health Service hospitals. And again, often these are in rural areas where it's just difficult for people to find themselves, you know, attracted to live in a place that has, you know, little resources. But there are also committed people who have been at IHS facilities for a long time. About half of the money that IHS gets is sent directly to tribes and tribal entities to directly run hospitals themselves. So there's also that, and those hospitals, you know, are not subject to this audit here.
Given the lack of federal funding that you just described, do the problems really begin or end at opioid distribution, or do they extend to other parts of this community, which could be chronically underfunded and perhaps in other areas of healthcare?
Yeah, there have also been other findings with IHS when it comes to the, you know, the amount of time that patients have to wait to receive any care at IHS. Some facilities have been subject to either temporary or long-term closures because of lack of providers. There's a constant shuffling of providers around IHS facilities. So it definitely doesn't, you know, just touch on the opioid crisis.
When we think about 2020, one of the issues that has come up with the Indigenous population members that we've spoken to, healthcare is at the top of the list. Has it gotten the attention of any of the 2020 presidential candidates so far? And I guess my next question would be, is the federal government doing anything to address this at the moment?
No, I haven't been tracking the presidential candidates closely enough to see if they've sort of honed in on healthcare. Obviously, multiple members of Congress mention it, especially those who have IHS facilities in their districts. There's always a push to get more funding for IHS, and you know that goes to the channels, and it's not always successful.
Well, given the recent attention on the opioid crisis, I'm wondering, do you think that this particular audit might change that?
Not sure. We did get a response, you know, from a tribal leader and somebody in Senate Indian Affairs saying, you know, they want to make sure that those more than dozen recommendations that the inspector general put in the report are followed up on, that IHS has some oversight, that, you know, these don't fall by the wayside. As far as, you know, funding that comes along with that, that would be up to Congress.
Felicia Fonseca is a reporter with the Associated Press based in Northern Arizona. Felicia, thanks for being with us.
Sure thing. Thank you.
Last year, beekeepers lost an estimated 41% of their bee colonies. In 2015, with the bees in trouble, the Department of Agriculture began conducting an annual survey called the Honeybee Colonies Report. It was supposed to keep track of bee populations and to assess the issues causing their decline. But the USDA indefinitely suspended that survey earlier this month, citing budgetary reasons. And that leaves beekeepers, farmers, and scientists without the data they need to understand these insects that help pollinate over one-third of the food we eat. On Monday, New York Democratic Senator Chuck Schumer criticized the administration's decision to suspend the survey and the toll this could have on agriculture.
The varieties and kinds of fruits will not be available. If New York is particularly affected, we'll have to import more stuff from overseas, and that's more expensive and less good for our economy. So this could affect the mom or dad just shopping for their family very soon.
I spoke with Ramesh Sagili, Associate Professor of Apiculture at Oregon State University, about the significance of the move by the USDA to suspend the Honeybee Colonies Report. And I asked him first just why honeybees are so important in the first place.
So honeybees are excellent pollinators. So about $15 billion worth of pollination in the United States alone is done by honeybees. And I think they're very important for our agriculture for sure, because we have been dependent on honeybees for the last 60 or 70 years in a big way. So just for example, the almond industry in California, which is about almost a million acres of almonds are grown, and then we need about 2 million honeybee colonies for pollination. So that's a huge impact on our agriculture. That's just one crop I'm talking about, but there are probably 130 different crops that are totally dependent or partially dependent on honeybees for pollination. So it impacts our food system in a big way, and also for our ecosystem too, because there are so many wild plants that also depend on bee pollination. So they're not only important for our food supply, but they're also critical for maintaining our ecosystem in general.
Now, we know that there's been a decline in the honeybee population across the country in recent years. What's led to that?
Yeah, it's a very complex problem. We researchers use the term multifactorial problem, because there is no one stressor that is impacting bees. We think there are multiple factors that are responsible for the bee declines that we have seen over the past decade. It includes poor nutrition, where bees are not getting diverse diet and abundant pollen and nectar as well. Then we have this serious pest called varroa mite, which is like a tick, and it impacts honeybee health by feeding on the adult bees as well as the larval stages. And then we also have bees that are exposed to pesticide exposure because they're foraging on probably crops that have been sprayed with insecticide that is used for protecting from pests. So this is a multifactorial problem.
Now, the United States Department of Agriculture has been collecting data on honeybees, and it's something they call the Honeybee Colonies Report. Why did they start doing that, and how common is this report?
So this started because I think the presidential memorandum that was released prior to 2015 during the previous administration had suggested few guidelines to a lot of different national federal agencies to protect bee health in general. So that was the initiative why this NAS colony loss surveys were started in 2015. And they're very critical for monitoring the losses over the past few years now.
The Trump administration has decided to stop collecting this data. What does this tell us about the current administration's thinking in terms of the USDA and research that it's choosing to prioritize? I mean, is this a question of costs and staffing limitations, or, you know, what does this really tell us? And how important is that data to our ecosystem and what you do doing going forward?
Yeah, this is my understanding as far as I read the news, that I think there were some budget issues, and that's the reason why this colony loss survey was suspended temporarily. But I think it's unfortunate because NAS colony surveys, they're really critical because they provide some real good information regarding status of bee health, which is vital considering the fact that the bee populations are under tremendous pressure from multiple stressors, as I mentioned before. Pests and diseases, poor nutrition, and pesticides. So if the status of bee health is not available, then it is not possible to respond to these population declines, and then it will not be easy to formulate strategies to improve bee health and thereby mitigating colony losses. So I think it's very important to monitor those colony loss numbers because it's not just a number. I think it's more than a number because we get information on potential factors that might be contributing to these losses. And that helps, as I said before, formulate strategies to improve bee health.
Ramesh, in the meantime, you know, anecdotally, we hear about Americans in their own backyards starting to become beekeepers, et cetera, and as hobbyists. But is there anything that average Americans can do to help the bee population in some way?
Absolutely. That's a great question. So as an average American, even if you don't have any bees, you can still promote bee health by providing habitat for bees. When I say habitat, not just the place that they can live, but also the forage, the flowering species of plants that they need to thrive in terms of both collecting nectar and pollen. So I think I would encourage all citizens to plant as much as they can in their backyards, not just some ornamentals that are not useful for bees, but something that provide both nectar and pollen for bees. And one more thing would be not use any insecticides in their backyards. I know if you have some roses or some plants that are in the backyard, and they may have some pests like aphids or some other sucking insects, but they can be easily killed by using some spray, like using soapy water or something like that, rather than using an insecticide, which might impact bee health. So those are two things that every American can do to promote bee health.
Ramesh Sagili is an associate professor of apiculture at Oregon State University. Ramesh, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Tanzina.
Sweeter than a honeybee, yeah, baby, been sweet on me. Sweeter than a honeybee, yeah, my queen bee. Oh,
so we asked you about the declining bee population and what you've been doing to help. And it turns out many of you are already doing some of the things that Ramesh suggests.
Hi, this is Dave from San Diego. I've been populating my area with milkweed for butterflies, bees, hummingbirds. Everything loves it. This milkweed is extremely invasive and aggressive, and it will take over, and it provides a really nice
orange yellow flower for all the flying insects, in particular bees, butterflies.
Hi, this is Ramona from Portland, and I planted my entire front yard with pollinator-friendly plants.
Hi, this is Patrick from Hooper, Utah. I do plant bee-friendly plants and flowers in my yard and encourage my neighbors to do the same, but I'm also a beekeeper with three hives in my backyard. It's likely the best hobby I could have found, and my kids love it too.
Hi, this is Doug calling from Orlando. I have a home garden, and I plant both vegetables and flowers to try to draw bees to pollinate my vegetables.
This is Frank in Virginia. I'm a beekeeper, and we plant many things to help our honeybees. We grow a lot of food in our garden, and with that, we share a lot with our family and our friends and our neighbors. We also plant pineapple sage, goldenrod, Joe pie weed, anise. Most people I speak with are pro-bee and pro-pollinator, which is nice.
Thanks so much for sharing. And as always, you can keep the conversation going on Facebook and Twitter at The Takeaway, or you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. And we'd love to check out photos of your gardens and yards and all the ways you're helping the bees. So share them on Twitter. Even if you've got just a little patch of outdoor space like me, I'd love to see. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.